This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us. On today's show, we are bringing in some experts across a whole range of topics. What link is there between self-esteem and confidence? What you wear and how you present yourself? We were in conversation with a clinical hypnotherapist and a personal shopper and stylist about a unique offering. We had head nurse Nora from the Gym and Retinary Clinic answering all of your pet questions, expert advice, and crucially, the costs of sending your child to university abroad. Meeting Ruby and her inclusion teacher ahead of the Special Olympics this weekend, and marking Cataracts Awareness Month with Moorfields Eye Hospital. Do you, be honest, look in your wardrobe and feel a little bit down? Maybe. Maybe it's clothes that you love to wear, clothes that you never want to see again. Or maybe it's a case of looking in the mirror and feeling a bit frustrated or even sad, stressed and tearful. Well, we're bringing together not one but two experts today. We've got in the studio the CEO of the region's leading transformative wellness community, Beyond Wellness. She's worked with some big names, some of the biggest in the business. Yes, I'm talking Kardashians. Rachel Dowd's with us, and she has joined forces with super stylist, personal shopper extraordinaire Sarah Silsbury to help you inside and out. So if you've got any style or fashion dilemmas, or you're having a bit of a crisis of confidence, this is your chance. Welcome to the studio, guys. How
Hello.
Are you?
Hello.
I'm not going to lie, I was a bit nervous about what to wear today. I was like, oh, they're going to be sussing out my style. But we've had lots of questions for you already, because I feel like a lot of people kind of lose their way.
Yeah.
And I love the idea that you're bringing together this sense of, if you fix one part, it then leads on to feeling better in other areas of your life. So I wondered, Rachel, if you could perhaps speak to how we look and how we feel and how that's linked in the way we present ourselves and navigate the world. What have you seen with clients and even yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, it's such an interesting topic. From working with women for so many years, and also men as well, we find that, you know, in the space of wellness, everyone's looking to feel better. They're looking to be on a self-development journey, and they're looking good. They're looking, wanting to feel good in themselves. And what we find is, a lot of the time we'll go in on this wellness kind of journey, and I run a lot of retreats and things like that. But what ends up happening at the end of this experience is that people want to look good at the end of it. They want to feel good and be, you know, looking good and feeling good from the inside.
So it kind of mirrors.
Exactly.
So do you find then that people come to you at a bit of a crisis point a lot of the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when people come to me, they come for a retreat or they come for some clinical hypnotherapy, they're usually at a bit of a crossroads in their lives. That can be from a career perspective, it can be their relationships, it can be how they're feeling within themselves. And Sarah and I were also saying, on our own journeys as women, you know, we go through so many different periods,
gosh,
so many different phases, you know, from having children to starting a new career to maybe being in a new relationship, people on a divorce journey, whatever it is. And in these phases of the journey, we kind of lose little parts of
100%.
Ourselves.
I mean, so what are some of the kind of pain points that clients come to you with, whether they're looking to, you know, edit the wardrobe or go shopping or have a complete, I don't want to say makeover, but, you know, really reassess? What's tripping people up that you're finding?
I think it can happen at any age, because there are so many physical changes as a woman. You have puberty, then we have pregnancy, and then, or if you can't get pregnant, that's a big deal as well. That changes your body. Then you get hit with menopause as well. So I think you have a physical change, which your wardrobe needs to adapt to. And I think the biggest trap people fall into is beating themselves up because they can't get into the same clothes that it did at 16. Yeah. I don't look like I did when I was 20. And no, you don't.
And then there's also like this crisis of confidence. Yes, but also crisis of identity, of like, who am I now?
Yeah.
Like, who
yeah.
do I want to be presenting myself to as the world? And I think, unfortunately, fashion gets a bit of a bad rap for being seen as being yeah. trivial or shallow, and it's not.
It's huge. And I think that who you see in the mirror is so intrinsically linked to who you are. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like what you see, it's very hard to just get on with the big things around you.
Well, this is exactly it. And when we think about confidence, I think everyone listening today has had that moment of, you know, I can't see in my wardrobe who I want to be today. But I've also had that moment of putting on something going, I feel fantastic. I feel ready to go on that date or give that presentation or have that interview. So I love that you're kind of marrying these two aspects. But I wondered if you could speak a little bit about how it works, Rachel, in terms of coaching and hypnotherapy when we're looking at the sense of identity and style in particular. What are some of the ways you're working with clients?
I think it's always interesting to see how people will reflect themselves in the mirror. So when somebody is feeling a certain way, they might have even gone on a journey and they might have got to a point where they're feeling quite good about themselves. I work with a lot of clients from, you know, weight loss to body confidence. And the interesting part that I start to see is a disconnect between when someone has maybe lost a lot of weight, maybe they've gone on a self-development journey and they're starting to present themselves in a better way. But actually, there's a story playing in the background. And that story is, you know, not feeling very good at the center of things. They might be looking so much better, but still their narrative and still their story is around, you know, not feeling very worthy, not feeling very good in themselves. So what we try and do with the Mindful Makeover, we kind of blend the two worlds of style and soul, we call it. So from Sarah's side, of course, she's looking at the styles that suit you, that suit your shape, the colours that work for you, the different things that reflect your personality. And then from my side, it's working from a clinical hypnotherapy perspective with, you know, what are those stories that are holding me back? You know, how do I feel good in myself and how do I reflect that to the world and show the person that I really am? And how can I shine as the person that I want to be?
We're going to be helping out some listeners next. Joining us live in the studio, Rachel from Beyond Wellness and personal shopper, super stylist Sarah. We're talking mindful makeovers now with the CEO of Beyond Wellness, Rachel Dowse, with us, and we've got personal shopper, stylist extraordinaire Sarah Silsbury. They are teaming up together to sort out, you said soul and style, Rachel, which I really like. Are we ready to take some listener questions?
Absolutely.
Let's do it. Okay. First of all, we had a question here, and I think a lot of people identify with this. Jean shopping is torture, to my mind. No Name says, I have literally 20 pairs of jeans from UK size 8 to 18 as my weight has fluctuated so much over the last 5 years. Definitely a security blanket in keeping them. Not feeling very happy in myself as a 14 to 16. Should I get rid of the smaller jeans? It feels like they're taunting me every time I open the wardrobe. What would you say, Sarah?
Yes, get rid of them. Just it does us no good. We just hold them up as something that we should be wearing. No, you shouldn't. You should look fantastic. You are fantastic. Find the jeans that fit, that make you look wonderful, and just get rid of anything that doesn't serve you.
I think we all, as women and men actually, get a bit hung up on the numbers and the labels.
Oh, ridiculous.
And tie so much kind of happiness to, you know. And actually, you did a great story on this the other day, Sarah. I saw on your Instagram about doing size comparison in a particular store, which just served to prove that actually it's a lot of nonsense that just messes with our heads a lot of the time.
It's 3 inches between, I think, a size 14 and an 8. It's not even that much. I mean, if you hold that up, it's such a minimal amount. Yeah. And we're so hung up on
it. And we attach so much meaning to it. A good point from Jennifer here saying, don't throw out anything. Donate to Thrift for Good. I actually took in about 10 pairs of jeans for Thrift for Good last weekend. So you're absolutely right. Dee says, and I think this speaks to your point earlier, Rachel, about the stories that we tell ourselves, saying, can you work with men? My husband's lost a lot of weight and is still wearing oversized golf t-shirt and won't listen to me. I also think he's worried about gaining the weight back.
I think this is exactly what we're saying, where we have this disconnect between how we actually look to our friends, to our family, to our colleagues, but how we feel inside. So this is a classic example of, you know, he's gone out there, he's lost the weight, he's probably looking great for it, but not actually realizing that he's a new person, you know, essentially he's lost a lot of weight. So I think he would be an ideal client for Sarah and I, actually, because what we can help him with is reconnecting to that new identity, finding that body confidence, feeling good in your own skin, and then really starting to wear the clothes which reflect that new identity and bring out the best in yourself.
I think sometimes it does take a pair of fresh eyes as well, whether that's on you and your body shape, if that's a new thing. And I guess establishing, Sarah, what you need and what you don't need. How on earth do you go into somebody's wardrobe and figure out what's unnecessary or indeed what might need to go on the shopping list with your expert eye? What kind of questions are you asking?
I mean, it's obviously individual to everyone because everyone does, whether they, you think you haven't, you have a sense of style. And there's some things that you think, no, I'm not being going that way, or some things that you think, no, that's too boring for me. So it's finding initially where you are with that. I think after that, we just look at what you're missing. What is it that makes your wardrobe not work? Why are you looking at it every morning and thinking, I've got nothing to wear, which we all do. Mm-hmm. So I always start with colour and body analysis. You can wear every colour, but it's finding the right shade to put that pigment back into your face, to make you look younger, to make you feel slimmer, if that's, you know, what you want. Colour is amazing with that, and we're often very, very scared of it. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to go to the text line because we've had a great question from Nadia saying, I'm late 40s, I want to look a bit more fashionable. I do have some nice things, but I want to buy things that are going to last. What are the five key pieces that could help me bring me up to date? She says, I'm tall, size 10 to 12.
I think the five things that spring to mind are white shirt. And when I say white shirt, you can't just go for any white shirt. You will have a white shirt. And this is so crazy, but whites are different. You can have different tones of white, and you need to find the one that works for your colour, for your shades and your body to bring out the best pigmentation in your face. So a white shirt is a big one. Good jeans, solid. Everyone needs a good pair of jeans or denim shorts in Dubai, maybe. I think a really good dress, but one that could go from day to evening, that I could help you style in a different way so that it works in your wardrobe. Everyone needs a dress. Obviously, if you're a gentleman, it might be a smarter pair of trousers. Then I think it would be down to accessories. Really good jewellery in your right metal, whether it's gold or silver, that works for you. A really good belt with tonal bag and sandals. And then the one that I make everyone do, not gentlemen, but a red lipstick.
I can't wear red lipstick.
Everyone says this.
Everyone says this. Because I've got dark eyes.
Honestly, Helen, you can. And what you think, you're thinking of putting it on, like slathering it on. Like, you don't. You put a tiny... When you're born, you have those beautiful, really deep coloured lips. Mm-hmm. As we get older, all the pigment goes. So all you're doing is putting a little bit... So you put it on your finger and you dab it on. You just dab it and you put the same bit on your cheeks. And I would give you the tone that works for you.
I am so dubious. Honestly, whenever I wear lipstick, I feel like I look like the ugly sister
from
Shrek.
No, I know. Everyone says it.
Okay, well, maybe during the news we can get the makeup bag out. Can you share a little bit about how it works? I'm sure there's lots of people listening going, actually, this sounds like I do need to change the narrative. I do need to change the story I'm telling myself. And my goodness, I need to sort out my wardrobe. So, Rachel, can you talk us through the process, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that we want to do things is make it as easy and stress-free as possible. It's already stressful enough, you know, just day-to-day life and trying to find, you know, ourselves a wardrobe. So what we want to do is take the stress out of all of that by coming to you. Sarah and I will come into your home. We will sit with you. We will understand a little bit about your kind of colours, your tones, your styles. We'll get to know you and the things that best reflect you. At the same time, there's so many different modalities that we can bring to the table that are going to make you feel better about yourself as well. You know, I can bring in the hypnotherapy. So that's also changing that narrative, bringing in some body confidence. If you want to lose some weight as well, we can be doing some hypnotherapy for that. At the same time, it's also about your environment. You know, how are things at home? We want to get to know you and understand a bit about the challenges that you're facing. You know, how is your relationship? We can help you and counsel you through that process as well. How are things at work? Are you stressed? Do you suffer from anxiety? Do you suffer from depression? Because all of these things will have an impact on how you're feeling in yourself. Mm-hmm. So through the hypnotherapy, through the mindfulness, through the meditation, through the breath work, these are all the tools and techniques that we want to empower you to be able to go away with and sustainably work with. It's not a case of you needing Sarah and I every weekend. I've got a function, you need to come, you know, and help me out. It's about giving you those tools, those techniques that you can work with in every single environment that you're in.
And then Sarah, we release you upon the wardrobe and the mall as well.
Yes, absolutely. I think when we've sort of worked out what suits you and what you need your wardrobe to do, I then do a wardrobe edit with you where I park things. I don't make anyone throw things away because I think people envisage I'm going to come in and rip everything apart, and it's not that at all, because there will be things in your wardrobe that will work. Mm-hmm. You're just not seeing them, how they will work for you. Then with what's missing, we work out what holes you need to fill, and then we might go shopping. Or I can, if you hate shopping, I can do it online for you or with you and bring it to your house, and we can do it that way.
Wow. I just thinking what a lovely gift this would be for, maybe it would be like a new mum or someone's about to start a new job, or absolutely, as you're talking about some of these career or relationship crossroads. A message here saying you can never have enough white shirts.
That you
said,
can't.
I've got a simple rule when it comes to the wardrobe. I buy only if I've got some space or I can retire something. Works for me. But for my wife, I've just bought her an extra wardrobe.
Oh, nice. That's the ideal.
I try to have a one-in, one-out rule.
I think we all do.
It's not really
we?
Working. But to come back to Jennifer's point, when it comes to if you've decided to not park it and exit it, do try to donate. We did a really good kind of organising show last week. We're Sorted by Kismet, where we've offered up some great places to donate. But yeah, Thrift for Good, money goes to a
Absolutely.
Great cause. So for anyone who wants to book, what's the best way of getting in touch, Rachel?
So you can find us on Instagram on Beyond Wellness DXB. And in there you can go to the booking link. You can see all the different packages. Or if you just want to know a little bit more, you can reach out to us and we'll arrange a call with you.
Tell you what, if you send me the word style, I will send over their contact details. That makes sense.
Fantastic.
All right, brilliant. You can get an idea of these. I have to say, you're both wearing white today, so you're definitely definitely walking the walk and talking the talk. Sarah, Rachel, really appreciate your insights today. I think a really great opportunity for people to rethink themselves and the way they present themselves to the world. So, if you want details of that, send me the word styles. Lovely to meet you guys properly in the studio.
So
and send me the word style 4001. I will hook you up. And now I'm going to hopefully get a little freestyle consultation and see if Sarah can actually find a red lipstick to suit. We are talking education this afternoon. I know it's exam season. I know there's an awful lot of stressed parents and students around right now. We're talking further education. What about university, that next step for so many students? And crucially, the cost of it. Joining us from Crimson Education, Mina Madhav Junja. How are you?
I'm doing well, Helen. Thank you for having me.
I thank you for being with and shedding a bit of light on the cost in particular, which we all know is a very, very important consideration when it comes to further education. And I'd love a bit of clarity in terms of how this differs internationally. We've had a number of questions asking about costs in the UAE, about applying to the US and for sports scholarships too. So are you okay to maybe break down for us, Madhav, a little bit about the costs of studying in various international countries? Because most students here will most likely be going to the UK, the US, Australia, Canada. What do we need to know?
Sure. I think the places you spelled out is fairly accurate. Those are the most popular study abroad places for students based in the UAE. I think the US is the most sought after, with the Ivy League being there, most of the sort of top 20 universities being US based. As you said, it does come with a high price tag. The US typically can vary anywhere between $35,000 per year, all the way till $70,000 to $80,000 per year.
Whoa.
When you add the tuition fees and the living costs associated as well. It does vary. There are sort of different types of universities as well. When you think of the high-end one, it's your high-rank private for-profit universities.
Mm-hmm.
And those typically would hover around $60,000 per year. So when you think of a typical bachelor's degree being 4 years, mm-hmm. which is, again, longer than most places around the world, in the US, you're looking at about $250,000 US dollar investment. So close to $1 million dirham investment. I will later on talk a little more about what the other ways to fund this are. So it's not all gloom. There are opportunities for students to sort of ease this burden on their parents.
I'm
as well.
Just thinking about when I went to university and, you know, my parents, you know, I got a loan, but my parents going, you know, you really need to make the most of this opportunity. And me being like, yeah, yeah. And now I think about, my goodness, how much that cost them and ultimately cost me. It's almost wasted on the young, because we don't take it as seriously, or I certainly didn't, as perhaps we should when we look at the financials. So $1 million dirhams. So this is for a BA, maybe average cost in the US. Now, the UK is a bit more complicated for a lot of people listening today, because they might be from Britain initially, which can make things a little bit more complicated when you start talking about home status, if people own property. But let's put that aside. For anyone listening today that wants to study in the UK, and we're putting, as I said, that as an international student, how the numbers stack up there, Madhav?
For the UK, you would look at, it's a little more complex because the cost also varies by subject. Medicine degrees are a lot more expensive than another bachelor's degree, unlike the US where it's largely standardized. So with the UK, when it comes to tuition fees and living expenses, as an international student, you're looking at a bracket between £15,000 per year, all the way up to even £50,000 or even more for certain programs like medicine, for instance. I think the other biggest sort of consideration in the UK is that the cost of living varies significantly between London and, say, the countryside.
100%.
So there are a few variables in play. But I would say the UK definitely is priced lower than the US. Mm-hmm. And the other consideration also is your typical bachelor's degree in the UK is a 3-year degree compared to 4 years in the US.
Yeah, Scotland to 4 years. But yeah, you're absolutely right. When we look at cost of living, even when I was at university, I went to uni in a city called Leeds. And I remember I was paying about, I want to say, £70 a week in rent. And my friend Jim was, you know, an hour or so down the road in Leicester, and he was paying about £30, you know, and it's quite staggering in terms of rent, you know, just general cost of living for, you know, transportation, your groceries, and then, of course, the education piece, depending on what you study. So that's the UK. Can we look at Australia as well, which is increasing in popularity as well?
I think Australia also similar price bracket to the UK. It does vary across public and private schools, but I would actually list it in a similar price bracket as the UK.
Now,
I think...
Sorry, go on.
Just to add to that, extension of the UK... I think what we do, even at our work at Crimson Sea, is Europe is becoming a destination of choice for two reasons. One is, I think it is significantly more price competitive than the US and UK. So price is a factor. We also see this with, I think, during the COVID pandemic and even post that, some families do sort of place value on proximity in terms of study abroad destinations. And that's where I think Europe is becoming a popular choice as well. And in Europe, your fee structure can be as low as 5,000 euros per year, with, I'd say, the typical program. Even if you look at the typical medicine, English taught medicine program, you're looking at about 13,000 to 15,000 euros per year. So a lot more sort of price competitive.
Can we talk about financial assistance, financial aid, as it's often referred to in the US? What is the process for applying for that? Who's eligible?
Sure. Let me actually start by giving my own example. And I feel like I was privileged with this. I got 100% financial aid grant.
Wow.
My parents did not pay a single dollar for university. And my financial aid grant was $80,000 per year. I studied at New York University. I was based out of the Abu Dhabi campus. And then NYU has this global network. So I still accessed a US degree and the global exposure. And I was fortunate. I'll walk you through my sort of process, which is, I think it's fairly similar years down the line as well. But broadly, when you look at funding, you look at two types. One is merit scholarship, and the other one's financial aid. So let's start with financial aid. Strictly, financial aid is need-based. That is, it's based on a family's sort of, family's financial requirement. Now, how students navigate this process is they submit a form. It's called the CSS profile. On this form, a student would list down their family income, assets, expenses, essentially all assets, all liabilities. And this document gives the university a snapshot of a family's financial situation. Mm-hmm. Now, there are different policies across US universities, and in some cases, even different for American and international students. I think in the interest of your audience, I'll focus a little more on the international students here. Broadly, there are two types of financial aid policies. One is need blind, and the other is need aware. Need blind, as the name suggests, essentially means when a university makes an admission decision, they're blind to whether a student requires funding and even blind to how much funding they require. So essentially, if there were three candidates with the same profile and one of them did not require funding, so didn't apply for financial aid, the other one could pay, let's say, 50% of the cost associated, and the third one could pay absolutely nothing. When the admission decision is made, none of these candidates would have a preference over the other. The takeaway from this is, at need-blind schools, applying for funding has no downside because it does not impact your admission decision. Now, the challenge is there are selective need-blind universities in the U.S. Specifically, the only ones that provide need-blind funding are Harvard, Amherst, Dartmouth, MIT, Princeton, Yale, and NYU Abu Dhabi, which is my alma mater. Now, when I've gone through that lineup, it's quite evident that those are the most competitive universities, I would say, even around the world. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially, they do have the endowment and they're committed to ensuring that any student, regardless of where they come from, regardless of race, regardless of financial background, can afford their education. So they're in a position, because they have this large endowment, to be able to commit to making education accessible.
Wow, so that's a lot to it's a lot to think about. I just want to come to the text line because we've only got a couple of minutes left. Which Ali's asking, how do you apply for sports scholarships to the US? Our daughter's a talented golfer. I mean, big industry, college football, golf, basketball. What about applying internationally? Is that something that you guys can advise on at Crimson?
Yes. So at Crimson, we have a full division, our athletic consulting division. The pathway is different on both sides. One is, even for the admission process, when you apply for athletic scholarships fall under merit scholarships. So there's it's almost like you're applying to a sports team or that specific sports division simultaneously while applying to the academic course as well. When it comes to funding as well, across universities, there are different divisions and different sort of athletic grants that are given to students. So it's a topic that requires a lot more exploration, mm-hmm. based on a sport, what level a student plays. Typically, you need to be at the international level when applying for sports scholarships in the US. So that's something our team at Crimson can definitely guide on.
All right, Ali, I will send you the details for the team there. And Nitin's saying, what a cost like here in the UAE for a BA? Kids are only 10 and 12, but good to plan ahead. It's good to have that comparison as well. And it's a topic I want to discuss on the show in the future in terms of just how big that adjustment is. As I said, I went to university an hour and a half down the road from where my parents were. And now you've got expat children and, you know, local children growing up here and going to university potentially on the other side of the world. Now, I think the standard here in the UAE, and you're talking about NYU there in Abu Dhabi, we've got Middlesex University, Birmingham here, is, you know, just getting stronger and stronger. And it is a more viable option for many young students. So what about costs and that comparison piece here in the UAE? What do we need to know about that bottom line?
I would say price range for international students based in the UAE, international universities based here, would be between 80,000 dirhams per year up to 150,000 dirhams. I'm not counting NYU Abu Dhabi in this range. Mm-hmm. NYU Abu Dhabi, as I mentioned, is actually $80,000 per year, significantly higher. But yeah, I would say that's for instance, the American University of Sharjah, American University of Dubai, the price points you're looking at there are about 110,000 dirhams per year, strictly tuition fees.
Thank you. We've unfortunately run out of time, but I think it's a really important topic. And as I said, one we've had a lot of questions on, so we will absolutely be revisiting this in the future. In the meantime, though, you have got lots of information on the website. What's the best way of reaching out to you and the team about any upcoming events or, of course, any consulting? What's the preferred method, Madhav?
You can go to our website, you'll find a contact number, so you can call us, you can WhatsApp us, you can just search Crimson Education Dubai. We also, this Friday morning, I'm hosting a coffee morning for mothers and dads who would like to talk about education after they drop their children to school. So I will be at Batil Cafe in Dubai Hills Mall. That would be at 8:30 a.m. on Friday.
Oh, there you go.
In case you missed those details, again, just reach out to us via Instagram, via anything or any information on our website, and you can contact us.
Thank you so much. I'm going to make it even easier. If you want to send me the word uni, I will send you the Instagram there. Thank you so much for your time, Mother. Really, really valuable. And hopefully it's answered a few questions for people listening today. And great to hear your personal story too. If you want information on that, applying for financial aid, and of course of that coffee morning that they're inviting everyone to this week, just send me the word uni, university, and I'll send you the details for Crimson Education UAE.
Your eye health on eye.
With Moorfields Eye Hospital Dubai. Eye care for you and your children. Moorfields, driven by your vision.
We're very much on hand to help. It is your live eye care clinic this afternoon, and we're talking specifically about cataracts today. It is Cataracts Awareness Month. Who knew such a thing existed? Dr. Imad Hakim did, consultant ophthalmologist. He does specialise in cataract and refractive vision correction surgery there at Moorfields. How are you, Dr. Imad?
Good, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, except I need a bit of clarity, pardon the pun, on all things cataract. So thank you for joining us today and indeed taking our questions, which we've had a number of. Can I start with the real basics? And I know this is your bread and butter, and I'm sure you say cataracts about a million times a day. What exactly are they?
I mean, the cataract is when the human being lens, which is located or sit behind the iris, get cloudy. It's more likely an aging issue. So we do have different types of cataract, the congenital one, which means children could be born with genetic defects and get cataract, or most likely it's an aging issue about the age of 65 when the human being lens get cloudy and the vision get blurry and dropped, and people start or patients start to have like a glare and blurry vision or halos around the eye.
And can I ask how common they are? And when we're thinking about that age group in particular, unless there's a genetic component, that, you know, or you're looking at the youth. But in terms of general population, how many, what percentage do you think of those kind of over 65s might develop cataracts?
I mean, it's very high. So that almost everybody above the age of 65, 70 will get cataract at some point.
Wow.
So, I mean, in Europe, we do see it a lot because we have aging population. In the UAE, we have young population, which means the cataract, it's less common in the UAE than in Europe or the US.
So what are those some kind of common signs and symptoms? You mentioned a couple of them. Can you expand a little bit about what we could look for in our own eye health or of that of any loved ones?
So most likely the patient do not have any pain or red eye. It's a painless and gradual loss of vision. So it does not come all of a sudden. Rather than coming gradually, the people, they start to complain, or patients start to complain about blurry vision, which comes gradually over months or years. When they start to see a blurry vision, do not recognize the faces anymore, and the far distance vision is more affected than the near distance vision.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to complain about like a glare and blurry vision, cloudy vision, foggy vision. These are the main symptoms. As I told you, it's a painless, so patients do not have any pain.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about, for anyone that might be under that age group listening today, Dr. Madden, in terms of, you know, preventable actions, you know, we can take to slow down the development of cataract. Anything, any lifestyle factors, supplementation, diet that we could be doing to, I'm not saying we don't want to meet you, but perhaps delay finding ourselves in your clinic.
I mean, having good nutrition, of course, is one of the main, main important things we have to do for our health in general, health and the eyes. And quit smoking is one of the risk of having developing cataract over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So if we talk about aging cataract, so there's nothing much to do about it. But if we do have cataract in young patients, let's say like mid-40s or 50s or 30s, they might have cataract as well if they are under medication, if they do have any other issues with their health, like taking steroids. Or we see it a lot in patients who have diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So they do develop cataract much faster than normal, like people who are healthy people, let's say.
Can I ask then about diagnosis? What are you looking for? What are some of the techniques or technologies that you're using at Moorfields Eye Hospital to establish if someone does have cataracts and may require intervention or surgery?
So if we are going like cataract, the only treatment to remove the cataract is surgery. So we do receive a lot of questions asking if there's any drops or whatever I can avoid or slow down the cataract. Unfortunately, you cannot do anything. The only thing to treat the cataract at some point is surgically to remove the lens and replace the lens with it, or like artificial lens. So what we do here is we do full assessment. We check the visual acuity, check the vision, and then we have to like dilate the pupil and check the lens itself to check how cloudy and how advanced the cataract is and how bad the vision is. So in order to give the patient the best recommendation if we have to do surgery or we can wait a little bit if we can improve the vision with the glasses or not. At one point, we will reach a point where we cannot improve the vision with any spectacles or any glasses, so we have to go for surgery.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
Your eye health on eye.
With Moorfields Eye Hospital Dubai. World-leading experts in eye care. Moorfields. Driven by your vision.
Joining us live on the line from Moorfields is Dr. Imad Hakim, consultant ophthalmologist who does specialise in cataract and refractive vision correction surgery. We are going to go to the text line. This is your chance to get the answers that you need. And Dr. Imad, we're going to try and get through as many of the messages that we've received, if that's okay with you, for to do a quick fire round. Is that okay?
Yes, sure. Absolutely.
Now, we were just talking about cataract surgery earlier, and Deb has been in touch saying, I've just been told I need my cataracts doing. I know it's a common procedure, but I'm scared stiff. The thought of anyone touching my eyes makes me flinch. Any advice? Can I get a sedative and will I feel anything? Can you do a bit of a virtual handhold for Debs and anyone else that might be facing cataract surgery?
I mean, most of their cases, we do it under local anesthesia, which means we numb the eye. Very good with eye drops, but if patient, in this case, I will go for like small sedation. So we can give the patient like small infusion. They feel like they like fall into sleep very shortly. So basically the surgery itself needs around 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. But we say the preparation for the surgery takes longer than the surgery itself. So we can put patients into sedation if required.
Okay, that's good to know. It's like when I had my wisdom teeth out and she was like, do you want something to calm you down? I was like, yes. Pass me the Xanax and everything was fine. No name on this message, and you can be anonymous if you prefer, saying, my husband had his cataracts removed in November 2019. He had lenses inserted, which meant he didn't need reading or distant glasses afterwards. Consultant told him his vision was good enough to fly a plane. All's been well until the last 5 months when reading has become difficult and he does need glasses. We saw an optician last week and she said there might be some haze under the lenses. Wants him to come back in 10 days for drops and a proper exam. Says there's nothing to worry about, but might need some treatment. Does this sound normal? Would really welcome a second opinion from your expert. Does that sound like something you've dealt with in the past? And any advice for this listener and her husband?
I mean, it sounds very familiar if the retina is healthy and the cornea is clear. So most likely she does have what we call it like secondary cataracts. The lens itself, when we remove the lens, we keep the bag, the backpack of the lens, the own lens, to carry the new lens. So with time, this bag will get some kind of opacity. Then we need to polish it or clean it with the laser. It's very an easy procedure if we are talking about this, if the optician is really talking about this kind of secondary cataract, which is very easy to be removed. There's no surgery at all. We do it like within 2 minutes just to polish behind the lens and the vision will return back to normal. If this is the case, what he's talking about.
Okay, and do you know what?
It's very popular. It is very normal to have it after. It's very common.
I will send you Dr. Imad's details, mystery listener.
Sure.
I've got your number so I can connect you there.
Mm-hmm.
Moving away from cataracts, I think a lot of people are just wanting your general advice as a consultant ophthalmologist, if you don't mind, Dr. Imad, saying, hi, Helen, please ask the doctor to shed some light on LASIK. Are you okay to talk about some corrective surgeries there and perhaps who might be a good candidate? Would you mind shedding some light?
I mean, LASIK, I mean, in order to know if the patient, any patient eligible to have laser vision correction, we have to do full assessment, like to know the exact power and to check the corneal surface, where we do a kind of pentacam, like an investigation called pentacam, to check the surface of the cornea, check the thickness of the cornea, the regularity of the cornea, in order to answer the question if patient, generally speaking, is eligible to have laser vision correction and which type of laser. Mm-hmm. There are multiple types of lasers. The laser vision correction, let's say, is the main title. And under this, the umbrella of laser vision correction, we do have LASIK, we do have femtolaser, we do have SMILE, PRK, trans-PRK. There are multiple procedures, there are different techniques, but at the end, they are all under the title of laser vision correction. So in order to know if this patient is suitable to have laser vision correction, we need to have full assessment.
Okay, so worth coming in and do a bit of a matchmaking process to see which one will be the most effective. Again, I'll send you the details for Dr. Imad.
Sure,
I'm paediatrics now, and I don't know if this is something you can help with, but I'm sure a colleague would be able to advise if this family was to come in. Message here saying, my daughter's eyes occasionally become squinted. It started when she was a year and a half. She's now 3 years old. She has perfect vision. But what can we do to get her eyes corrected? So just a little one at 3 years old. Is this something that you've worked with at Moorfields?
I mean, it's not my specialty, but I can highlight this issue. So we need to have the child examined in our pediatric department. So it's really, we need to know if the base squint can be fixed with glasses or not, if there's any refractive error that had caused this kind of squint, you know, if there's anything to do about it, or it's a very minor squint which does not affect the vision or cause any kind of double vision. So we do not need to fix it, and there's like specific age to have surgery done. So it depends really on what kind of squint the child has. And this is like question more for the pediatric.
Yeah, and
do
you know what, doctor? My daughters have been to your pediatric department at Moorfield, and I know I shouldn't say this. They had a great time. they had like a really happy couple of hours meeting various experts. So the team there, really, really friendly and used to working with little ones. So again, we can connect you. And last question, it's about night driving. Message is saying, I really struggle with night driving. I've done numerous eye tests and can't find the cause of not being able to see clearly. One doctor said it's psychological. Nothing's happened to cause it physically or mentally. Any ideas? Now, in terms of how the eye works at night and specifically around driving, where there's obviously movement and different types of lights in different parts of, parts of the environment, is this something that you notice in certain demographics, or is there anything you could point to why night driving might become an issue?
I mean, night driving, we need to check first, to check the health of the eye completely. We need to check the cornea, this is the surface of the eye, and check if there's anything on the cornea, and to check the lens, if there's any kind of cataract could cause any, like, blurry vision at night. And the most important one is the retina, to check the background of the eye. So these are the main assessment we have to do it in each examination. This is number one. Number two, we need to check if there's glasses or there are glasses needed to correct the vision at night. Some of the patients, they do see during the day very well because they do have enough light. Mm-hmm. And they do have, like, night vision, let's say, disorder or any, like, obstacles or difficulties. So we can, like, provide them with glasses only for night driving. So we need to know if the patient has had any refractive surgery done before, any cataract surgery done before, any issue with the eye, and to examine the eye so we can give our full assessment and see why the patient is having this issue.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Imad. To everyone who's sent in a message today, I will send you the details for Moorfield. But anyone can just thank you. It's been really, really valuable. And is it weird to say happy Cataracts Awareness Month?
Thank you.
But wishing you and the team there all the very best. And if you want Dr. Imad's details or that of Moorfield, just send me the word eye. You can even send me an eye emoji and I will send you those information. Dr. Imad, really do appreciate your time. Consultant ophthalmologist there at Moorfield Eye Hospital. If you want details, get in touch.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Get ready to be inspired. So delighted to welcome to the show two very special individuals. We've got Horizon International School's Ruby Hamilton, 17 years old, who's flying to Berlin this weekend to represent the UAE in the Special Olympics rhythmic gymnastics. And we've got Miss Lisa Riley, the head of inclusion at the school, who's been Ruby's teacher on links for the last 4 years. So I am so honoured to have a chat with an Olympian. Ruby Hamilton, how are you?
Hello.
Hi.
Go on, don't be shy, Ruby. Rude. She's a little bit shy, Helen. Apologies.
Don't be shy, Ruby. I've met you
before. She's been buzzing about this all day. So we're going to say hello, Ruby Rue. Come on.
Don't worry, Ruby. I want to hear from Miss Lisa and all the hard work that's been going on behind the scenes. Tell us a little bit about how you've been preparing Ruby for these Special Olympics that are happening this weekend. What's been going on?
From a school point of view, I suppose how we've been supporting her is adapting her timetable to suit her training schedule. Mm-hmm. So her coach, Sarah Mercer, and her mum, Stephanie, have worked really hard behind the scenes to prepare her. But in school, she sometimes comes in later in the mornings or leaves early in the afternoon. So we've just adapted her timetable to make sure we make the most of the time she's here. Mm-hmm. And also we've tried really hard to keep her morale and her motivation up. So as you can imagine, training every single day and at the weekends can be quite tiring. So she has been really tired, but she's been an absolute trooper and really powered through for the last couple of weeks. And she's been very busy the last 2 weeks in particular. She's been raising the profile of the Special Olympics around the school as well, which we thought was really important for her to lead on. So she's been in and out to nearly every primary school class, presenting not only this journey, but her previous journey to the Special Olympics in Abu Dhabi a couple of years ago.
She was there competing in rhythmic gymnastics, which I've seen the videos on Instagram, and Ruby just an absolute legend when it comes to the personality that you'll see on her Instagram, but also the athleticism that has been demonstrated through her and the team. In terms of inclusion, and I've spoken to Ruby's mum, Steph, before about just how challenging it was for Ruby to find a school when it comes to that true sense of inclusion. As a young woman with Down syndrome that just how challenging it's been to be included and integrated. And I wondered if you could speak, Lisa, a little bit about what you do as a school, aside from, you know, Ruby today and going to Special Olympics, but what other measures are in place to make sure that there is that true meaning of inclusion?
Yeah, so Ruby is not known as Ruby who has Down syndrome or autism. She's Ruby who dances around the corridor, and that's how every child knows her here at Horizon. She's been with us since year three. She's now in year 11, and she has a very personalised, bespoke curriculum. So we do focus on her academics, but we really put emphasis on building those life skills and getting her ready for life after school as well. Mm-hmm. So she has particular ASDAN lessons, for example, that we've tried to incorporate daily work experience. So if you see her on a daily basis, you might come in and see her on reception answering phones or doing admin tasks. You might see her with Mr. Marvin in the, our cafe serving customers or cleaning up, stacking the shelves, or her favorite is down with Miss Kathy in the library, isn't it, Ruby Roo, scanning all the books and making sure everything's in order, and keeping Miss Kathy on her toes as well. So it's putting as much emphasis kind of shaping her as a young beautiful young lady that she is, as well as making sure that we're kind of adapting the curriculum for her academic progress as well.
So off to Berlin at the weekend. Ruby, are you excited?
You excited, Ribs?
Yeah.
Yes. Come on, speak loud. I've seen the practice. You've been working so, so hard, and you're making the school, the whole of the UAE, so, so proud. Now, you are on Instagram, so if anyone wants to follow you, it's I Am Ruby Hamilton. You can check out all the work that's been going on behind the scenes. Miss Lisa, thank you so much for your time. Explain a little bit about what's been going on, not just around the Special Olympics and going this weekend, but on an ongoing basis to support Ruby through her studies and these extracurricular passions as well there at Horizon International School. Ruby, Miss Lisa, thank you for your time today. Keep us posted. I'm going to be checking out your Instagram and seeing just what happens this weekend at the Special Olympics in Berlin. Really appreciate your time. And as I said, doing the UAE very proud indeed. Ruby Hamilton there.
You're listening to Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan, where the number one ingredient is always high quality salmon, lamb, turkey and chicken.
Fantastic to have you and your pets with us this afternoon. I know we've got a few furry listeners tuning in to Dubai I-103.8 today. It is Pets and Vets, your little slice of animal crackers every single week. Joining us to help out today is Nora, the head nurse at the German Veterinary Clinic. Thank you so much for your time, Nora. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm really well. It's going to be a busy one, so buckle up. Before we get to the text line, tell us a little bit about what your job entails there at GVC. And I'm also curious about what's going on at home. Do you have a menagerie? Have you got some pets of your own?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I've actually been at German Vets for 9 years. I'm a veterinary nurse for almost 15, and I came to the UAE in 2014 to basically launch German Vets being the first cat-friendly clinic in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So that was my reason for coming, and I'm super passionate about cats in particular. So in my time here, I've actually rescued 3 cats from the clinic and at home, and I also potentially we'll be getting a tortoise soon. So we have a tortoise here at the clinic I might be taking home. So strange combination, but apparently it normally goes pretty well. But yeah, I've got my 3 now aging elderly cats at home.
Now, I love it when people send in the names of their animals on the text line. It's nice to get listener names, but I really love to know the names of animals. I find it fascinating. So come on, Nora, what are your 3 called?
Okay, so one of them is called Barry, and his official name is Barry the Cat. He's kind of my husband's cat, the love of my husband's life. And then we have Pumpkin, who's this little ginger female. And then the probably cat love of my life is Freddie, and his official name is Freddie Pants. I'm not really sure why, but so I first met him not long after I arrived, and when I got here, I was, you know, single and in an apartment here on my own, and it was me and Freddie for a while. And we've kind of lasted these 9 years together.
Well, I'm a big lover of pets with human names, to be honest. I say that with 2 dogs, one called Jarvis and one called Lucy. So if you are messaging in this afternoon, let us know what your pets are called. Now, it's interesting you're talking about love of your life there, because there's been a survey done in the US. So, you know, forget about your star-crossed lovers. Half Americans surveyed believe their soulmate is their pet. So around 2,000 pet owners reveal 53% believe their pet knows them better than anyone else in their life, including their best friends, their family members, and even their significant others. Nearly half, 45%, tell all their deepest secrets to their pets, and 72% swear their pet can tell exactly what they're feeling at any point in time. I can almost hear you nodding along, Nora. Are you in agreement
yes,
with this?
I am. Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, your pets, they see you at your best, at your worst. There's no judgment from them. You don't have to put on any sort of face. I mean, even with our children and our spouses, you still want to act your best at all times with your pets. You can be you. Mm-hmm. So it's understandable that people feel that way and that you can develop that sort of relationship. I mean, it's unconditional love, really.
It is. And that's how I felt. So we have, speaking of dogs with human names, our old dog, Lizzie. No disrespect to Nick Farmer, who might be listening this afternoon, my husband. I feel like she kind of was the love of my life. You know, we would lock eyes. And it was exactly that. There was no judgment. She was just the purest, kindest soul.
This is Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan, groundbreaking science, life-changing nutrition.
In conversation this afternoon to talk all things animal, we have stolen away the head nurse of the German Veterinary Clinic, Nora, to take your questions and mine on 4001 on the ARN Play app and the WhatsApp too. Nora, we've had a couple of ear questions. I hope that's all right. Kiara's been in touch saying, my dog gets repeated ear infections. Today, his behaviour's been quite odd, quite whiny. She's even vomited. Can I stop the medication that we've been given? I think she says it's called Apoquel. I don't know if that sounds like something that you're familiar with. Can you shed some light on that and ultimately what this listener can do?
Yeah, I mean, Apoquel is a medication that is for dogs that have skin issues, allergies, itchiness. It's a very, very good medication and it definitely helps when they have an ear infection. What I would say is that first of all, obviously, they should see their vet to get a diagnosis. So lots of times when our animals have ear infections, we want, you know, an ointment, something to put in there and to help resolve it. But without knowing exactly what's causing it, we might not be able to treat it effectively. So really, when it's repeated ear infection, the most important thing is that we're able to get a swab from within the ear canal, and then we can test that in-house in the laboratory. Sometimes it needs to have a culture done just so we can find out exactly what bacteria or what fungus is causing it so we can treat it effectively. So getting over-the-counter cleaners and things like that will not solve the problem. It will keep coming back. So occasionally it does actually require a sedation for dogs because if they're very, very sensitive and very, very painful, we don't want to force that on them. So sometimes just to give them a very light sedation is the best way because then you can have a really good look down. You can get the sample that you need and then you can get a diagnosis and get it fixed.
Thanks, Nora. Kiara, time for the vets. Make sure that diagnosis is correct and make sure that doggy is okay. Staying with ears, Ben's been in touch saying we've got a labradoodle called Woody with big floppy ears, which are usually managed by the groomers and stay fine in between. However, noticed a few days ago that one of the ears is very waxy. We've been using an ear cleaner, getting lots out, but it's not making any difference to the matted waxy hair in the canal. It's in two awkward positions to cut it and I don't want to pluck it in case it hurts. Does this need the vets or will it eventually shift with cleaner? Ben says, I should add, dog sees completely unbothered and seems to quite enjoy the cleaning sessions. Is this something that requires some veterinary help? Could this be a sign of something else even?
It can be, and it can be that it's not bothering him right now, but it might in time. I mean, cleaning it is great as long as you've been instructed properly how to do that. Lots of dogs won't tolerate having the liquid squirted down their ears, but a nice way is to soak some cotton wool with the cleaner, and then you can gently clean it. However, if one ear is overproducing wax, it could be a sign of a bigger problem. Mm-hmm. Right now as well, with the change in weather, the humidity, the heat can also cause dogs to be a little bit more prone to having some ear issues. So they sweat like we do, and when they've got long, floppy ears, it could be something that becomes more problematic at this time. So great that he enjoys the cleaning sessions. You know, you should definitely keep them up. But if you're noticing that it's more than normal as well, definitely just get it checked.
All right. Really hope that helps. Can I ask you, Nora, what's kind of coming into clinic? You mentioned there some kind of topical or seasonal issues. Do you notice any trends about what's keeping you and the team busy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the time of year that we start to see heat stroke, unfortunately. So if animals that are previously are fine to walk outside or spend lots of time, and then when the shift in the weather happens, sometimes owners aren't aware at how greatly that can impact their pets. And we do see heat stroke, which is very serious, and it's a complete emergency. Mm-hmm. Animals normally collapsed, panting, and they do need medical help right away. So we do normally see that through the summer months. There's lots of different viruses in that, especially in the cat community, that has seasonal. It's not sort of related to what time of year, but there will be periods because they're so contagious where we'll see lots of one disease, like feline panleukopenia. It's the cat equivalent of parvo. We'll see lots and lots of that for maybe a month, and then it will calm down completely and we won't see it again for another few months. So yeah, they do kind of come in waves.
I hear that you did a brain surgery recently on an animal. Yeah. Tell us about that, Nora.
Sure. So I didn't do that personally, but I was part of it. Dr. Sergio is one of our amazing vets here, and he specializes in neurology. And it was pretty exciting. So about 10 days ago now, we performed it's called a craniotomy. This little cat, tiny little thing, 2.5 kilos. She had a invasive tumor, brain tumor, and we were able to surgically remove it. So it was quite a big operation. It's pretty special. It's not something that's done very often, and it's not easy to come by in a vet to actually have that level of expertise. So it was quite special. I mean, for me personally, a bit of a career high to be part of that. And yeah, she's recovered beautifully, and she's back to herself completely, which is amazing.
I think it really also speaks to the amount of care that, you know, you guys as vets, as nurses have about really caring about those animals, even when you're at home, you know, and staying those longer hours and staying in communication with pet owners. Yeah. It's a real calling, Nora. It really is.
This is Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan.
Joining us to offer up some expert advice is Nora. She's the head nurse at the Gibbon Veterinary Clinic. So if you do have any questions or concerns, you are more than welcome to reach out. So let's go to the text line, Nora. A message here from Kelly saying, my poor pup Roxy scraped one of her front paw pads for the third time in about 8 months. It's like the top layer has been scraped off. She is limping. We're keeping it clean. We're putting some balm on. But does Nurse Nora know of anything better to use or how to even toughen up her pad to stop it happening again? It's not heat related. Thank you so much. What comes to mind, Nora?
I mean, first thing that comes to mind is pain. So they said that she's limping a little bit. So I think that's really important that gets addressed. You know, dogs and cats are extremely sensitive on their little pads because it's the only part of their body not covered with fur. So if you think about it, the rest of them is a little bit less sensitive. So any sort of trauma, any sort of injury on their pads is really going to hurt. It's going to affect them. So definitely get some pain relief on board through your vet. And also just be conscious that if that's open at all and she's walking outside, there's bacteria everywhere. So it can quickly lead to a bacterial infection. So you definitely want to make sure it's covered. You can use like a baby sock or an adult sock, depending on what size Roxy is. But definitely keep it covered when she goes out for any walks because it can quickly escalate. As far as sort of toughening it up, it's something you want to wait to do until that's fully healed. But I think sort of increasing the roughness of the surface as she walks on, if she's, you know, inside all the time and on tiles, then maybe taking it up to grass before going out on pavements, mm-hmm. Sort of slowly. But definitely you need to think about preventative care right now and making sure it doesn't turn into a bacterial infection and making sure it doesn't become more painful.
Thanks, Nora. All the very best to you, Kelly, and little Roxy. Any excuse to buy some doggy booties, I say.
Exactly.
Keep us posted. Taryn's been in touch. A fellow Cocker Spaniel lover, just like me. Boy Chips is turning 14 this month. Cocker Spaniel who's lost his hearing. Is there any kind of solution, any hearing aids, any advice? Oh, can you get Spaniel hearing aids? Is this a thing or what do you tend to recommend in clinic?
Sure. So it's not something that I'm familiar with. It's definitely not something that's on the market here. But what I would say is the most important thing for a 14-year-old dog is to definitely do a full, we call senior checkup. You want to make sure that it's not just his hearing that he's suffering with, because if he's lost his hearing, you want to make sure that his sight and everything else is working well. So a good senior checkup where they run full panel of bloods and do a full checkup, full physical checkup, is really important. He's going to rely on his other senses a lot more. Mm-hmm. There are some different supplements and medication on the market for aging dogs that just sort of helps with their cognitive function. But as far as the hearing aid, that's something that I should probably refer to our neurology doctor. It's not
a whole new market out there. I know they've got, you know, doggy goggles, but I don't know about hearing aids. But I think you're absolutely right. You know, we often don't notice as our dogs get older those little changes, whether it is cognitive or indeed sensory. So a good senior check for Chips. Although, oh bless, please send a photo of Chips. I've got a 10-year-old cocker and a 7-year-old as well. So I do love a senior dog. Nora, you are the perfect person to ask this question. Dina's been in touch, and you're a cat lover. You've got three. Dina says, "We used to have cats over 10 years ago. Now we have dogs. Our neighbours found some kittens in their garden with no sign of mum, and they've asked if we'd like one. We've been over. They are gorgeous, friendly kittens, and we can collect one this weekend. So what do we need?" She's saying, "We've got a carrier. We've got food, bowls and a bed. What else? Also, we need to slowly introduce the dogs. So any advice there? We are going to keep one upstairs and the dogs downstairs to start with. So what would be on your shopping list, Nora?"
Okay, so cats are all about their resources. They need to have plentiful resources. And for cats, their resources are food, water, litter trays, also safe places to hide. But those would be the big ones. So you've got the food and the water, which is great. We want to make sure that they have more than one opportunity, more than one space they can eat and drink. So maybe a couple around the room or the level of the house that this little kitten will be on. Litter trays are super important, and there's so many issues people have with cats not using litter trays because they don't know the litter tray rules that cats know. So we should have, for every cat, we should have at least two litter trays, because in nature, cats will not urinate and defecate in the same spot. So for them to only have one litter, it can be quite stressful. It doesn't mean they won't use it, but it can lead to some issues later on. So if you're getting one kitten, make sure you have two litter trays. It's fine to get a little kitten litter tray for now, but just know that when the cat gets bigger, it will need a bigger litter tray. So the kind of rule of thumb is that the litter tray should be 1.5 the length of the cat. Mm-hmm. It should be fairly deep, so you can put an inch or two of litter in, so they have proper room to cover what they've done. So you want to make sure they've got lots of litter trays. And definitely I would get some scratching posts. Cats, it's just in their nature, they have to use their nails. They have to sharpen them. Those are their, you know, their weapons. They are hunters in nature, and they will use your couch or your curtains if you don't give them an alternative. So definitely a couple of scratching posts is important.
Well said indeed. Protect your furniture at all costs, Dina. I want to ask you a little bit more about the clinic, Nora, because you spent 4 years working at a cat hospital in Ireland. It was Ireland's first cat-only veterinary hospital, and gym and veterinary clinic there in Abu Dhabi, you know, really passionate about creating, I guess, a cat-friendly space. But what does that look like in practice? And are there any things that cat owners listening today could perhaps be learning from you in terms of being cat-friendly and cat-inclusive, sure, if that's the thing? So what do you think sets the clinic apart? Maybe we don't even notice, but you know it's helping those cats.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about respecting them as their own species. The old school veterinary way is that cats are treated as small dogs, and we know now they're not. They're completely different. They have very different needs. So in a cat-friendly clinic like ours, we have consult rooms that are cat only. So no dog ever, ever, ever enters that room. So there's no smell of a dog in there, which cats may find intimidating and stressful. So we have very sacred spaces that only cats can go into. Our hospital rooms are the same. Cats and dogs are completely separate. The same with operating rooms. A cat will never enter a room where a dog has been here. The biggest thing I think with cat-friendly practice is the handling and the team that are doing the job. So all of our team here have undergone training with a really, really great organization called iCat Care about cat-friendly handling. So a big thing is we would never scruff a cat. I think lots of people see the scruff as being a good way to control a cat in a difficult situation, but that is very stressful to a cat. So that's something that we would never do. And all of our team sort of follow the same cat rules, I guess. So we know how to respect them. We understand their body language, what they're telling us. If they're scared, we give them a place to hide. You know, we don't force situations on them that they're not comfortable with.
Thank you for that. I think it's really fascinating to think about just the care that goes into it, you know, in terms of these safe spaces, the sense and more. We've got time for one last question, and it is a cat question from Duncan, saying, hi both, I have three cats. One of them is overweight. The vet has recommended a weight management cat food for him, but how do I provide that while still allowing the other two cats, who don't need to lose weight, to eat normally? Any insights there for dealing, I don't want to say fat cat, but yeah, maybe in a larger body without having to sacrifice the other two's eating habits?
Yeah, I mean, it's first of all really great that he's taking this action. He's concerned about his cat's weight and we can do something now. I think what I would always say is it's not always so much about what food you give the cat, but it's about how you feed them. So again, going back to understanding cats and their nature, the natural environment for a cat is obviously plentiful with rodents and that to hunt. So a cat in its natural state would eat about 16 very, very small meals a day. They don't have a big bowl full of food all day that they can just help themselves to. Mm-hmm. And help recreating that in your home is a really great way to manage a cat's weight, but also to keep them mentally stimulated. They don't get the opportunity to hunt, which is such a core value for them, their hunting ability. So hiding food around the house, having scavenger hunts. There's a number of different products on the market. One is called Doc and Phoebe's Feeding Mice. And you basically ration out the amount of food in the mice and you hide them around the house. And the great thing about this, it's not something that just the overweight cat can do. Mm-hmm. All three cats can enjoy that. And it just means they'll all have a more active lifestyle. There's no worry as far as the other cats becoming underweight with that. It would just start to replicate the natural way a cat eats, and it will definitely help to regulate the one who's a bit overweight. You can also combine some of the diet food with the normal food so that it's okay if they're all getting it. Mm-hmm. If it's absolutely not working and the other cats are miserable, there are microchip reading food bowls.
What?
So each of your cats would have, yeah, that each of your cats would have to have their own microchips already. And then you can set them so that only a cat with the registered microchip number for that bowl is allowed access to it. Mm. So in this family's case, the two that are allowed their normal generic diet that they would have access, but the cat on a diet wouldn't have access.
What so, a time to be alive, Nora. Every day is a school day. Thank you so much for advice this afternoon. So helpful and so lovely to hear about your passion and about Freddy Pants, Pumpkin and Barry the Cat. Really appreciate it. All the very best to you and the team. We had then Head Nurse Nora from the German Veterinary Clinic. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.